It was fully charged, plugged into a public meter. It was a raked-back, egg-shaped affair of carbon fiber and plastic windshield on three wheels. I swiped the chit Watton gave me by the window, and the car unlocked itself, and the doors swung up into the air. I settled in, running my fingers over the wheel, adjusting the seat just so. Luxurious. My father used to take us out for special family trips in his car, when the farm had mulched up enough biodiesel in the yard pits. Just like then, when the doors shut, it was just you inside. Like when you walked into your own house. The outside world seemed just that. Outside. A barrier between you and everyone else. It was like one of those animes where the hero puts on invincible, giant techno armor. There was an appeal to this. I always found the electrics more fun than the combustion ones as well. Instant torque all the way down through to the wheels in an electric. No hesitation. I cruised around Detroit, slipping past the downtown section. It was a fortress, new and shiny buildings with their backs to the slumps. The hardy core of a new Detroit, where people could live in walking distance to jobs and necessities. Where the city touched the river, and boats with massive parasails for mobility delivered their cargo along the docks. I drove out into the slumps, paralleling the river, aiming for the bridge, with a stop near a park where a team of kids were playing baseball. One of the little leaguers of some reclamation crash was happy to sell me a bat for cash before the coach and chaperones chased me off. The expedition continued to the edge of the bridge, where I found an alley looking out at the main street across. Most of the homeless appeared to have left the sidewalks for the strange city, just evident in the distance under the ruins of the bridge. Things were pretty quiet, just the occasional person wandering down the road on whatever errand they were on. I fished around inside my pockets and found a pair of painkillers, which I dry-swallowed. Then it was the long wait. Hunting was never for the patient or the hungry. Eventually, after several hours of seeing homeless wander by who weren't the lawyer, I ventured out to look for somewhere to eat. The alleyway my car was in sounded busy. I paused after turning the corner. The car had been cut to shit with the axes, door panels slashed clean off, windows yanked free, and all of this left quickly as I'd arrived. Everyone had fled. I got in the car, the door creaking sadly as it swung up and sat in. I shut the door, looking nervously around, and tapped the accelerator to get the hell out. As the car lurched forward, the 36 well-dressed people of all ethnicities came out from their hiding places and started running down the alleyway behind me. They wore suits or cargo pants with the ponchos. 10 of them carried sharp-looking axes, while the others had large bags. A couple of them had a sled dragged behind them. This didn't look good. The car was in bad shape. It coughed to a gentle stop as some part fell off from underneath onto the road. A silent and expectant mob surrounded me as I got out of the car, the bat gripped in both hands. I would need to grab an axe as quickly as possible after the first couple swings, I reckoned. But the crowd moved back from me. "We don't want any trouble," one of the axe wielders said. "We just want your car." "Storing carbon producing energy in a battery still doesn't change the impact of the original source of the energy," someone shouted from the back of the crowd. "Damn footprinter!" It was the second time I'd been called that. "Shut up, Mary," the axe wielder said. "Sir, just step away from the car." "If you can't see how to take care of your footprint, we'll do it for you," the woman shouted. "Mary, shut up." The axe wielder turned back. "You are not helping matters." I still stood there, bat in hand, keeping everyone at bay. "What do you want out of me?" I asked. "Just your car," the man said, exasperated. "What the hell is going on?" I really wanted to know. I felt like I'd fallen down a hole into some alternate Detroit. "We're turning this area of Detroit into a car-free zone. We're lead front scavengers, looking to recycle any cars in our occupied territory into useful machines and products. We have a reprap to repurpose the materials. That's our job. I didn't know what a reprap was. But even though things were hard on cars these days, you couldn't talk about turning Detroit into a car-free zone with a straight face. These guys were nomadic extremist nuts of some sort. But what'll you do with the parts, I asked. What's the point? The guy grinned. Oh, we'll put them to good use. A pair of the crowd advanced on the back end of my car and smacked their axes into it. Hey, I yelled, pointing my bat at them. But the moment was past. They'd written me off as a threat and began tearing into the car with gusto. So I grabbed the guy nearby with the axe and twisted it free. His friends hardly even noticed, too caught up in their fervor for car destruction. I dragged the man, wrapping his cloth poncho around his neck and arms in a knot he struggled against, down to a set of steps away from the destruction. What the hell? He gasped. Dramatic, yes. And yet it got the attention I wanted. Now I had an axe. And a bat. I held the axe up and looked at it. What's your name? I asked casually. Charles? Charles, pleased to meet you. I'm Reginald. I loosened his poncho. That fascist bullshit doesn't fly dragging me off like that, Charles spat. Just like these other homeless, he was well-washed, well-shaved, with short cropped hair. I squatted in front of him. Charles, I could care less. You chopped up the car I was renting. I have to think that violates my rental agreement. So you know who's gonna get flack for that? Me. That puts me in a bad mood. And I'm the guy with the bat. And I'm the guy with some 10,000 other guys sitting just down the block, Charles said. Fair enough. I set the bat and axe down. Okay. I pulled a chocolate bar out of my pocket and unwrapped it. Just explain to me what's going on. I waved my hand out at the camp and the people on the side of the street. Charles still sulked on the stairs. I tried again. You're all nomads, right? Passing through Detroit? Like Maggie, but in large tribes. Like locusts.
Yeah, nomads. Low-footprint nomads. We don't stress out the environment. Take what we need into recycling. Recycle what we have. We're here, but we're not part of the city. Not part of the resources being sucked.
So what are you doing with my car?
You ever ride a bike? Charles asked me.
Yeah, when I was a kid.
It's a perfect technology.
10 to 15 miles an hour for the energy required for a human to walk.
And humans are good at walking, Charles said. Evolutionarily, we're designed to just walk and walk and walk all day long. Eat some calories and watch us go. But look at this shithole.
He waved his hands around the street. Not a bike-friendly city? I hazarded.
Fuck no. We're in the second century of having this perfect technology, but we kept focusing on something far less efficient. The streets aren't bike-friendly. The wilds aren't friendly. Detroit and a lot of these other Midwest cities are throwing money at electric cars and power plants that run on coal, thinking that if they can just swap things out, life can run right back on the course it did. Meanwhile, people run in gyms or just get fat because they keep using the lazy technology. At 10 miles an hour, man, you can live within 15 miles of your workplace and still get in.
He had more, a complete rant, but I held up a hand. My car, though. Charles looked back at me.
People don't make voluntary changes. They just float downstream, even when there's a freaking waterfall at the end.
So you're going to make people swim upstream?
No.
Charles laughed.
We're going to blow the river up. The car makers, their ghosts are still playing with the city. We're going to make it a carless city, whether they like it or not.
I picked up the bat. Edgewater was dealing with eco-terrorists. The last thing I wanted to do was get between the eddies and these guys. Things got ugly when you were dealing with people who'd already thought the world was ended.
thanks to people like the Eddies. No amount of lost love between authorities and eco-anarchists. But I still wanted paid. And their little tent city under the bridge hid the lawyer. I cradled my bat in my arms and left Charles on the steps. Around me, people were dragging the remains of my rental off down the street in what seemed like 30 different directions for scrap. Or recycling. Or to whatever a reprap was. I promised myself that I'd be out of the city before the crazy shit started happening. But as I came out of the old soot-stained brick buildings and looked out at the empty pavement and weeds in front of me, I wondered if I'd made an empty promise. The entire tent city had disappeared. A single distant figure stood alone in the urban emptiness, as if just waiting for me. I recognized the lawyer, even in this distance. The lawyer waited for me by his bike, both hands holding his briefcase in front of his waist. "Mr. Stratton, you are a very persistent man." I swung my bat up over my back, letting it hang loose, gripped by my right hand. I wasn't giving him a hand to shake. "Where'd they all go?" "Staying in one place invites complacency and authoritarian response. Takes time to muster the resources to evict a group of our size. But there were thousands of people here with tents and avenues between the tents," I protested. "They can't just evaporate in the morning when my back's turned." "And yet they did." I stood in the concrete emptiness, forced to concede his point. "A well-ordered army, then." The lawyer smiled. "Now, Mr. Stratton, you're getting to the meat of it. Are you intrigued?" "I want the rest of the money." "I know. You willing to follow this all the way, then?" I wasn't sure what he was getting at, but I nodded assent. "I want paid." The lawyer leaned in with a tiny black wand, which he waved over my body. Around my collar it beeped, and the lawyer flicked a switch. A tiny mote on my collar smoldered, then puffed smoke. "Now that the Eddies can't follow you, I have a request," the lawyer said. He produced a dark blue hood. I stared at the cloth. "You want me to wear that? You think the Eddies can't just patch into a satellite and find where your mob took off to?" The lawyer sighed. "Granted. But where in the camp you are will be secret." "Yeah, okay. Here we go." I pulled the hood on. "But I'm keeping the bat," I said, my voice muffled. "Whatever you want, Mr. Stratton." The lawyer sounded bored. He pushed me forward. "There's a sidecar on my bike. Please get in it." Why hadn't he had me sit first before putting the hood on? To mess with my head? "So are you a part of all this, or are you just a turking lawyer?" I could feel him climbing onto his bike. We jerked into motion. "I'm a part of the project. To destroy the auto-oriented world of Detroit? Among other things, Mr. Stratton. The world cannot continue on its current path." The lawyer was huffing as he pedaled, getting us up to a quick clip. "We have returned almost to the time of city-states like the Greeks. Each of these cities has a different past and set of traditions and patterns set into its habits. Some of these habits have a fundamental impact, however, on citizens elsewhere. If you dump some form of pollution into the air from a smokestack somewhere, and people are affected hundreds of miles away, shouldn't they have some sort of say? It used to be there were countrywide principles and guidance, but in this day and age, it's city to city. Now, some of us don't have allegiances to any one city, particularly those of us old enough to remember nationalism. You know what I'm talking about, Stratton. You fought for country once, not city." "Didn't do much for me," I muttered. "But I remember the days when bunting hung from porches and second-floor windows." "We have no allegiance to country, city, or company. We're neo-tribalists at best, but even then, not forming around any constitution or hierarchical structure. We're per-project affiliations, with reputation economics as our bond. Some of us stick from one project to another. Others are committed to the larger plan of trying to create substantial mimetic change to our urban environments. Like getting rid of cars. That's a sub-project. One that many have coalesced around. Some of the more enthusiastic, like those who recycled your car, yes. But the energy use and issues of transportation are realistically a small segment of the greater issue of creating a city or environment that is carbon neutral and thus sustainable. We're talking about the long-term survival of the human species, Mr. Stratton, not just whether you recycle plastic and go to work in the approved transportational manner.
I've been hearing doom and gloom for a long time, I grunted. The end of the world's always just around the fucking corner.
And you think it won't come? The lawyer zigged through the streets. Some alleys, too, I could tell by the echoes of our voices. You think civilizations haven't collapsed? Someone or something else will come along. They'll name some streets after us, maybe create a museum. We still find ancient cities by satellite after the jungle or desert has long since overrun them. Why'd they die off? Overuse of the soil, or whatever, or just plain bad planning when it came to picking neighbors. But the point is, their world ended. You can nuke a patch of ground and the radiation will kill everything. Years later, nature comes back. Generations later, some parts of it are livable. Still doesn't mean setting a nuclear bomb off in the middle of your living room's a good idea. Sounds like a lot of drama. We're sitting on an edge, Mr. Stratton. You've seen it all change in your life. The young around us, they've only known the slipping and scrabbling, watching energy prices spiral out of control. They're content to root around in their parents' and grandparents' trash to look for whatever they can recover. But you know better. You can feel it that your life straddled the point where we hit the apex and then started sliding. Remember when we used to make things? I remembered the long factory lines, the smokestacks belching, the rows of gleaming product sitting perched over enticing price tags, all packaged in sexy gleaming plastics. They made so much you just tossed it all when you were done, because they'd make more. We descended down a ramp of some sort, and the world grew dark on the outside of my hood. The lawyer slowly came to a stop and reached over to remove my hood. "Don't ask where you are," he said. "I'm a delivery man of sorts. Now that I'm here, I can't leave, but you may have to, and you can't know where this is. Most of the people in here don't know where it is. Keeps it safe." I clambered out into the barely lit dimness of an industrial warehouse, the windows all blacked out. As my eyes adjusted, realized it was entirely empty. Until the doors swung open. People wearing large data goggles over their eyes walked in. I could see that none of them could see where they were or what was in front of them. But they marched in like robots, following invisible lines of information. More came in carrying chairs, some with desks that they sat at predetermined points. They swarmed around each other like ants, following some larger pattern of commands. Maybe hundreds of them had already swarmed in through the room, and most had gone. Large industrial work lights lit up the inside of the warehouse, and an entire command center's worth of monitors had been strapped to a large metal trunk at the center, which had been quickly bolted onto the concrete floor. Thick fiber-optic cables ran all over the warehouse, terminating in a large trunk of bound cables that ran to a dish pointed out of one of the windows that had been pulled open. The entire process had taken 5 very surreal minutes. The crowds all evaporated, leaving 10 individuals behind. One of them sat in a complex wheelchair that folded around him and held him up at eye level. It whirred and balanced and trailed cables behind it. Inside the wheelchair, the gray-skinned man moved closer to me. Sunken eye sockets, lids stitched closed, and plastic-looking cheekbones. One missing arm with what was left plugged into a socket on the chair. No legs. They were hidden in the depths of the chair. One ear was missing as well, replaced with a metallic ovoid sitting over that with three blue lights steadily on. "I've been recruiting you," the man slowing in front of me said. The wheelchair raised a bit higher so his face was level with mine. A small pair of cameras on his shoulder adjusted their focus with a faint whir. Someone tipped off the eddies that I was watching them, and someone didn't pay the other half of what I was expecting. For some reason, I'd been allowed to keep the bat. But bashing on a man with no legs, one arm, and no eyes was not going to be part of today's equation. Guilty as charged. "Mr. Stratton, we're looking for a leader. Someone who knows the area, and someone who has a good sense of the Edgewater contractors here. There are a number of candidates, but you're a serviceman with a record and a good idea of what we'll be facing." "Listen," I wasn't sure how to ask after his name, so I floundered for a second. "My tag is Mock Turtle, the community moderator for this project." Mock Turtle. A little bit of this and a little bit of that. An amusing name for a man who was as much machine. He saw my amusement through his camera and nodded. "Yes, I do find some humor in my situation. The alternative was despair." "Okay, Mr. Turtle. The lawyer pitched me hard on your cause." I looked around the warehouse. "I'm not interested. If people want to bike and walk the town, that's their thing. I'm not getting involved in some riot." The wheelchair backed away. "We're not, as such, asking you to volunteer. We're willing to pay for your services and settle up on what you think we still owe you." Now we were talking. "I'm listening. An apartment in downtown Detroit. Maybe even continuing work as security for it." "A lease? How long and how much?" The ruin of a man in front of me chuckled. "You're not paying close enough attention, Mr. Stratton. See, at first we weren't sure who we'd pick or hire to run the street side of this project. But then you showed up, turking for us. It was a sign. Who better to run this than someone like you, down on your luck and needing the help? When you started snooping around, well, we had to bring you in. We're offering you an apartment. A whole apartment." I stared. Like I said, there were some that would give their left nut for downtown space. I included myself in that list. "So you're gonna riot to turn this into a car-free city. And you need my help." Too good to be true. It all was. And if there was one thing I learned in life, it was a little suspicion. No way a downtown apartment's worth it for my help. You've already got an army. Well trained. You showed it off when you set all this up in here a few minutes ago. The Mock Turtle spread his one arm. I recognized what those scars came from. A landmine. Boston or D.C., I wondered. "You're right. It's not just the cars. That's a diversion. An important issue, yes. But we're involved in some urban renewal as well." "Which is where the apartment offer came from. They'd paid Maggie to try and overnight," I remembered. "I could put a few things together." "You gonna try to occupy the slums, are you? All these nomads, they were going to settle in, try and reclaim some of these buildings." I could have laughed. "Not really, Mr. Stratton. It's more complicated than that. We make no guarantees, but I will put a good faith payment up in escrow right now. Consider it a down payment on the apartment. We need a dedicated team of protesters to keep the Edgewater contractors busy, but the protest cannot get to the size that the military is called in. You have to both keep the protest in line and keep it out of the Edgewater's reach. It'll be a delicate balance. If it works, and if our project works in the meantime, you'll have an apartment of your own.
if the project fails. You are one of several people offered large cash payouts for your services on the ground rather than volunteering your time. You will still get an equivalent pay. We are fair people. We depend on our word and reputations. Down the rabbit hole, off to meet the Mock Turtle, and now to engage in even more silliness. But these Mad Hatters were certainly offering cold cash. I checked my phone, and the bank confirmed an escrow offer. The Edgewater guys. We're hands off them, right? Yes. Then I'm your guy. Mock Turtle smiled. Welcome aboard, Colonel Stratton. I cringed. That's why you came to me? Of course. Welcome to Starship Detroit. You have a silly name, I said. You might not think so when we're done, said the strange man in the wheelchair. I was in the heart of the sleeping dragon I'd sensed curled up in the darkness, the thing that S. Wanton feared. I was deep into the crazy shit. CMO S. Wanton, in his permanently wrinkle-free working suit, looked surprised. Didn't think you'd show back up. Didn't think I'd be back. I handed him a receipt. I refunded your payment. There'll be a claim on the car. It was wrecked. Wanton took a sip of coffee and looked down the street at the pair of men who'd biked me over to the compound. Stratton. Colonel. I'm considering calling in reinforcements, or at least talking to the Edgewater board. I'm guessing that there are thousands of these people lurking around the city. I think you're overestimating, I replied. He wasn't. He was way, way underestimating. We tried to get satellite pictures of their camp from the other night, but someone has blocked it. A clever trick. I don't know the size of my enemy or their nature. And now they have a known counter-Turk army specialist. You spent years taking down networked insurgencies, Stratton, overseas. Now, if I didn't know better, you seem to be working for one. I leaned forward until my face was just an inch from the chicken wire and bars. They are eco-freaks, Wanton. They applied for a protest license. No one gets that anymore. The right to assemble and protest had long since been finessed into oblivion. Didn't stop them from happening, just meant you had no right to do it. I know. So they're going to go ahead with it anyway. And we'll have to stop it. I'll need reinforcements. Tell me why I shouldn't bump this up. A gentleman's agreement, I said. I promise that the protest will not exceed a number. How many can the local eddies and their compounds handle? Wanton chuckled. I tell you that, and you deploy a larger number and I'm up the creek. He sipped from his mug. Wanton, I shit you not, I'm trying to do you a favor. These are people who are going to do this one way or another, but they're scared of you. Remember fighting for country, the way things used to be. That's what they're after. The right to express dissatisfaction without getting a skull cracked. They hired me to keep it civil, keep things from getting crazy, because I have that expertise. Now, I could hire toughs to keep a barrier going between us, could get snipers up in the roofs, could make for some real ugly back and forths. But I just want to make an easy buck. We keep it small, balanced, and you get to round up some easy fines. They get to make their point. I get to make some serious cash from these hippies. One grunt to another, Wanton. Let's make this easy. I watched the gears turn. You really think this'll go down that easy? Do you want the board staring down too close into your operation? You want them calling in military? National coverage of the event? Serious battle? Wanton looked off in the distance. Some of my men are a bit jumpy by now. Control them. Offer them bonuses for a calm day of rounding up these guys. Tell them chaos is not welcome. Tell them anything you want, but tell me what your threshold is for kicking the protest upstairs.
I see more than 300 people. I'm calling in reinforcements, Watton said.
I'll keep it to half that.
Half that? Watton looked incredulous. It's not going to be a protest. It'll be a lunch date with a bad ending.
Half. Thank you, Watton.
Call me Samuel. If it goes the way you say, I'll even shake your hand when it's all done. But Stratton, fellow grunt or not, we're going to round people up. And if it gets big, it's going to hit the fan. It isn't just my men who are jumpy. I'm getting it, too. I'll call the second it looks odd.
I know. I handed Samuel Watton my phone number. We'll keep in touch. Keep the lines open, the air clear, just in case. I walked back down the street, blinking in the morning sun. Charlie, the bike enthusiast, waited for me.
So?
The Eddies can handle 100 protesters.
Damn it.
Charlie hit his bike handles in frustration. There is no way we can shut Detroit down with 100 protesters.
I smiled.
We have an hour to do it, and then we have to keep doing it for 24 hours.
Come on, Charlie. Don't you believe in the vision enough to trust me?
He just stared at me. I laughed. We'll need far more than 100 people. We'll need thousands and thousands.
But we're trying to avoid getting the military to come out after us, Charlie said.
No more than 100 can gather and protest. But the rest of the city is still a tool, Charlie. They still have eyes. Charlie was frustrated that the citizens of the city wouldn't work to change their paradigms.
But they would. He had just had to Turk them out in just the right way.
Detroit, late morning. The first dry run I chose was near Grand Circus Park, a big intersection near a run-down Gothic-looking church. A set of roads ran semicircle around a portion of the intersection as well. I sat cross-legged on top of a large stone block, in front of which was a statue of a sitting man. It looked like Charlie's wet dream. 100 bikes converged from 4 different directions. Mock Turtle had given me a list of thousands of possibles, and I'd chosen the fittest, with the fastest bikes. Speed would be an essential part of this equation. A small smile quirked the side of my mouth, seeing the 4 sets of 25 bikers stream in at full tilt, pedaling away. They all braked to a sudden stop at the center of the intersection. Now the chaos came. Cars with green lights braked, confused at the sudden clutter as the bikes made a barricade around the square of the intersection. Waiting in electric utility vans was my support crew. I picked up my phone and selected the mailing list. Roll out, I typed. 50 men leapt out from the backs of the vans. My heavies. Anyone with a self-defense or military background. They lugged plastic cones and began placing them around the edge of the bicycle barricade. I slipped on a pair of shades and let them talk to my phone. I needed more screen real estate, because now things would get tricky. The more practical drivers, realizing something was afoot and not wanting to get caught up in the middle of some riot or demonstration, began to try and start turning their cars around. Finally, the signs went up, declaring the area a car-free zone. I could see Charlie standing with a bullhorn. Behold the rhetoric. Burn the gas using relics of a failed era. Embrace the pedal-powered and walkable future. All around the city, I'd deployed bikes, messengers, and paid Turks to call in the location of the Eddies. Small flags started popping up in my vision on a map of Detroit via my heads-up display glasses. Scrambling Eddies. Security out. 10 to stay, I sent. And the heavies melted back into the vans, which peeled off, a handful remaining off to the sides. The Eddies were ripping up Washington Boulevard toward us. When they crossed Michigan Avenue, I tapped in the scatter signal. Just as abruptly as they had appeared, the protesters scrambled onto their bikes and took off in every direction, leaving only the stalled and snarled traffic, the cones, and the signs. I hopped off the public art and strolled down into the park near the empty fountain, then turned back to watch as the eddies waded into the mess we'd created. Angry drivers, confused eddies, not sure if it wasn't the drivers somehow involved. Some of them were. Paid to have trouble turning around, that was. There was some small part of me inside chuckling. Being on the other side, there was a sort of beauty to this creative destruction. I'd always suspected there was. 20 Edgewater contractors in full company uniform were a bit frustrated. I called a randomly selected heavy. Atwater and Bates, start forming it up. It was close to the tunnel to Canada, enough to really freak the eddies out. The fleeing bicyclists would find warehouses, shops, and eateries to duck into. Beta Group was activated and ready to go. An electric waited for me at the far end of the park, and hopefully Charlie and his pals would leave this one alone long enough for me to get through the day. After swinging around the effects of jammed traffic, I headed for a view of the next mess. I found a spot a block away from the intersection and parked the car. Lit up my heads-up display glasses. The eddies were chasing bicyclists. They'd capture a few, given the 10 SOS flags I saw. Time to send in the lawyers for them. Atwater and Bates, go, I ordered via my phone. The bicycles kicked into gear and my heavies moved onto the scene to stand ready with cones and signs once more. Since the turn of the century, mobile networked insurgencies had been upsetting balance of force in urban environments for first world militaries. Infrastructure, Stratton. Infrastructure. As laws ate away at the rights to demonstrate, free-form riots had begun to grow, imitating the guerrilla tactics abroad. Standing still for a protest didn't make any sense. Not when rioters would get classified as non-state terrorist entities when rounded up. The trick was to control your membership. No violence. Which was hard to do when real insurgents waited in the wings to join protests as a cover for whatever they had in mind. And when the Edgewater types paid Turks to bring violence to a protest so that they could shut it down and levy massive fines for pure profit, one had to be quick on their feet. Damn quick. Even as my protesters set up, I saw eddy flags popping up on my HUD map. They were reforming, dropping their chases, and coming my way. Samuel Watton was smart. Eyes on the ground reported a detachment of 15 eddies regrouping at Grand Circus Park. Security out, I ordered. And then as the eddies approached, I ordered half the protesters to evaporate ahead of the brunt. The remaining 50 scattered tire-piercing jacks with Bluetooth signals, giving up information about the negative effects of personal transportation as practiced by the city currently. I was sure the drivers would be thrilled with that. But the message delivered was this. Today, any cars in the area defined by the river and Interstates 375, 75, and the Lodge Freeway would be harassed. Charlie shouted it. Agents delivered messages to blogs, podcast hosts, old media outlets, and placed battery-powered projectors on overpasses all around this section of Detroit we'd staked out for the protest. Here be no cars welcome. Of course, we couldn't shut down every street leading in, but if we caused enough trouble and spread the word, enough people would get the idea and stay away because they didn't want to get caught up in an Edgewater roundup and riot. The effect would be the same. And I had a few specific goals up my sleeve. I ordered protesters to pedal out. We had a few more non-critical intersections to demonstrate at. A few hackers under our pay tapping into Eddie radio chatter reported that the order was going out for all the compounds around Detroit to contribute extra contractors. All Detroit Eddies were getting yanked out of bed no matter their shift. Riot gear was being passed out. Things were getting warm. I yanked Charlie off the streets and had him chauffeur me around in my electric car. Things were getting complex enough I couldn't drive and coordinate at the same time. Enough people had heard his talking points and been briefed. They were handed loudspeakers and told to carry on the crusade. Plus, Making pedal-powered Charlie drive me around appealed to me on a deep level. "Spaceship Detroit," I asked him. "What do you know?"
"It's the higher-level project," he said from the front seat. He was doing his best to follow my orders, but not chat too much. Driving me around really had irked him. It cheered me up. I was running a big diversion, and I wondered if true believers like Charlie knew they were just turking out. It was like one of those games with a purpose you could play online. You thought you were taking over the world in a digital simulation, but instead you were helping develop an algorithm for bottle-packing computers based on your reactions to certain variables. I had to admit, I was enjoying myself a hell of a lot more than I was working as a bouncer just a few nights ago.
"It's noon," Charlie said.
"I know."
"So?"
"Give it a few minutes," I said. We passed by a series of office buildings. I could see faces in windows looking out. Word of a potential riot had gotten out. People were checking the streets before leaving for lunch. We continued driving. As I drew more and more people into downtown, I wondered what would be happening in the slums. Spaceship Detroit, huh? I just hoped it wouldn't be a massive piece of multiplayer performance art or something stupid. Maybe some of the rhetoric had stuck on me. It would if people flung it at you long enough. I would love a walking city, like those European ones, where they'd eased into post-auto societies due to their medieval city layouts and historically high gas prices. I'd visited them, on my way to the trouble spots. A city where I didn't have to scrounge out in the wilds, where the slums were utilized, and where it felt like there was action and hope. I liked the sound of that.
"They're coming out now," Charlie said.
He was right. The lunch crowds were starting to form. "Okay. Lunchtime madness," I ordered via my phone. Groups of 25 in 5 different packs descended outside popular restaurants, blocking off the roads to them with demonstrations. Again, jacks, signs, and cones to muddy everything up. Charlie's acolytes preached their slogans, and people did their best to get away from the traffic snarls. The Eddies, now out in patrols in full force, and having gotten a sense for the rough area we'd staked out, descended quickly. They'd spread out in a rough net and were using their own information to quickly rally to a point. Turks with live cams gave me feeds of each demonstration, as well as streamed them live to anyone who really cared. Already some people in the city were honking horns whenever they saw a pack of bicyclists going by. Drivers, sympathetic to the cause. Funny. In the middle of protest number 3, my heavies dragged out a bicyclist from the middle of the group. Discreet, quick, they tossed him into the back of a van, and my phone rang. "He didn't have an ID," they reported. Each official protester had a small RFID tag that responded to a challenge response query that the support team could broadcast via their phones. "Try and work out who he's getting paid by," I said.
"He doesn't know. Just turking it," was the response.
"The Eddies are thinking quick. Take him out into the slums and dump him off." Lunch had been successful. Late and annoyed business people, traffic tied up in all 5 locations. And we still were keeping just ahead of the increasingly frustrated Eddies. A few of the protesters captured since the first demonstration had been shoved around a bit. But it was still civil. "Lunch is over. Afternoon delight begins." I smiled. For the next 4 hours, they just kept shifting the fun around the city, frustrating the traffic and Eddies. Eating into rush hour traffic as everyone left just added to it. Drivers jumped at every little glitter on the road, imagining tire-piercing jacks waiting for them. Outraged bicyclists not associated with the riots were getting arrested throughout the city as they tried to get to buses or home. The temporary protests appeared, vanished, constantly moving about. At this point, some of them were riding in the vans, getting dropped off in locations faster than they could bike to. And to be honest, there were closer to 500 bicyclists working for me, hidden all throughout downtown. Even though the Eddies now had extras coming in from the slumps and the wilds, I was prepared to keep this up all through the night when Mock Turtle called. "We have a problem," he said softly. Outside, the sun was dipping over the skyline, the buildings throwing their long shadows down the streets. "What kind of problem?" "Edgewater is advancing on the project. They're liable to misinterpret what's going on." "Well, what is going on?" "Come and see." And the directions to one of the skyscrapers in the slums popped up on my phone. As we drove deep into the slums, I realized why Edgewater might get nervous. As night fell, thousands of people were crawling out of nooks and crannies. Even as we drove, the streets were filling with people. People were working on portable machine shops or turning out parts via automated stamping machines. Others ran up and down the street with carts and toward the center of all the activity. Spaceship Detroit. The skyscraper loomed over this section of the slums, where the buildings made perhaps 15 stories at best. Massive solar panels had already been mounted to the upper deck and outside the windows, jutting from the building like leaves from a demented scrap metal tree. Charlie swore and stopped the car, and I got out. Dump trucks of soil lined the block, the air hazy with dust as they dumped dirt onto conveyor belts leading into the building, where vacuum hoses and other contraptions moved the dirt elsewhere. And everywhere, a swarm of humanity working furiously. Mock Turtle wove his way through the sidewalk, people blinded with their visors and tasks magically moving aside at the last second, a sea of humanity parting for him in his wheelchair. "Welcome to the single most coordinated sudden attack of urban renewal ever witnessed," he proclaimed. 200,000 souls dedicated to turning this building into a sustainable structure." My knees were weak. The Eddies are going to call in the military. Since dawn, we've been quietly working on the infrastructure of the building inside, doing as much prep as we could. Parts have been manufactured off-site for months now. We've all been rehearsing on 3D models in massive multiplayer online simulations for a year since we identified the target. It's going to take 8 more hours to get the soil in, and then finish the interior modifications once that's in place for the full occupation. But what is it? Why did they need soil? People have been taking over unused buildings and repurposing them in decayed areas for as long as we've had cities. But what is the point in taking over structures like this if we don't have any new paradigms to offer? Mock Turtle led me back toward the building. Inside the giant lobby, people were working on a series of ponds. Sprinklers over my head went through a testing cycle, briefly dropping mist into the air. My host continued. "It began in an online game that let people design homes. Many used it as a place to test how to make more efficient homes or redesign existing homes in niches in cities. Eventually, the designers realized we had the economy of a small country, and so they wondered how they could face some of these problems of how to be responsible dwellers. Out of that grew a community plan to create an embassy to the world. We took a glass elevator up through the building's levels. I was seeing apple and orange trees and rows of furrowed soil. I recognized all this. Farms. They were building farms. Like the skyscraper farms in New York. No need to worry about seasons. Much more efficient acreage. You could reuse the water as it filtered down via gravity. We used a squatter at first. That triggered a response from the Edgewater contractors here to evict that person. They have a contract to protect this building. Our hackers were able to then follow the report that Edgewater delivered about the incident back through several shell companies to the actual owner of this building. We'd passed 20 rows of farms and garden, and now it turned into apartments and corridors. That information was made public, prompting liens and back tax collection actions against the owners, which forced them into bankruptcy.
Now we're claiming ownership and offering to pay taxes and be good stewards under a subsidiary company based out of Turkey.
Turkey? I said. Why Turkey?
We have allies at the top in America. Allies who want us to succeed, who played the simulations, who know what we planned. And from a simple financial point of view, if we own the building, we'll pay our taxes, raise the value of the building, and maybe even offer a plan to revitalize the slums. Since we put in a claim via a Turkish company to build an embassy, ostensibly for Turkey, we are technically on Turkish soil. They have a rule that says if you can build a building in a night where the owner doesn't notice it to try and stop it, then you can stay there. So we will be allowed to have this land if we can finish this project in one night. But the previous owners, under a reconstituted company, are counterfiling, having the building taken away, and are trying to stop us by getting the Eddies over here, because we have no building permits and we're taking up the streets. It's all legal fictions and weirdness, but we need to stop the Eddies from coming over here. He'd taken me to the top of the building, where a carefully landscaped set of gardens sat, with a waterfall trickling away already. I understood. Spaceship Detroit. A whole building that could sustain itself in all manners. This wasn't recycling our forefathers' leftovers, or scrabbling about for what we could get today. This was its own direction, and it could be made right on the foundation of the existing. So how bad do you want that apartment? I could take you to see it. It's just under our feet. Recycled oak floors, 2 bedrooms. I held up my hand to quiet him. We looked out over the twinkling skyline. I'd had a feeling it would come to something like this. Riding the back of the tiger meant getting bashed up. It never came without consequences. I need 300 very dedicated people, I said. Not the cyclists. People ready to get hurt. Because the Eddies are not going to go easy. You can have thousands, Mock Turtle said. I shook my head. Any more than a few hundred is going to get the military involved. They'll be able to meddle with the project easily enough. We want just the Eddies to stay involved and away from here. What are you going to do? I pointed off in the distance, by the park, the Detroit Opera House. We take and hold it all night. It pushes over from nuisance into hostile, but with only 300 of us, and them thinking it's today's protesters, they won't escalate this into a major emergency. But get your lawyers ready. Mock Turtle reached out with his good hand. Thank you. Don't thank me yet. I looked out over the city with a sinking feeling in my stomach. Was it just about the apartment now? Or had I gotten sick of skulking about in the wilds by myself? Or had a strong taste of the Mock Turtle's Kool-Aid gotten to me? A little bit of all of the above, I figured. We rushed the security guards quickly enough, and I set teams to boarding up the doors. Jacks were scattered on the streets. Protest signs wavered on the walls outside, thanks to projectors dropped all over the street. Charlie had stuck with me, and he looked at the team. Not a lot of us here. Enough are, I said. We have to hold out until we get the all clear from the project, or until we're all rounded up. The Opera House was a recognizable building, a part of the history of the city. The Eddies would not ignore this. Sure enough, my phone finally buzzed. CMO S. Watton. Stratton? I'm getting reports you're at the Opera House? We're barring ourselves in for the night. I could see on my heads-up glasses that the Eddies were starting to stream this way. You sure about this? Watton asked. We were just about to get a temporary city ban on bikes and end the whole protest. You want to take it up to this? It's too late, Samuel. I looked around at the project volunteers. We're here for the night. The first Eddies were pulling up at the perimeter of our Jacks field. But then so were hundreds of people on bikes and cars and on foot,
coming to see the latest star singer, sports player, or whoever they idolized. Thanks to personal interest profiles and thousands of Turkers working to invite them down to the Detroit Opera House for a special showing of whatever it was their interests indicated they would come down to see for a free showing. These people weren't working for anyone or getting paid. They wouldn't be classified as part of the protest. But they were indirectly working for us. The Eddies formed up, clearing away the jacks. Their riot teams rolled up and out with battering rams to come in after us. "Frustrated fans, execute," I ordered. Outside, whisper campaigns started. The Eddies were here to take away the impromptu concerts being planned. They were here to ruin the fun. Now this was incitement. The project's lawyers were going to have to earn their money when I got bailed out later tonight. My streaming video didn't show who threw the first bottle, but when it broke on the pavement, the Eddies moved their focus from the Opera House to the massive crowd outside. Charlie, sitting next to me in one of the balcony seats, swore. He was looking at the streams on a small pad in his hands. Outside erupted. It was clear enough these weren't anti-car protesters. The Eddies had a two-front war on their hands now. It bought us until just past midnight, as the Eddies had their backs to us to deal with the frustrated and unruly crowds trying to get in. "You don't have room in your cells for us," I told Watton when he called me again. "Why bother now?" "We'll make do," he hissed. He sounded tired. The friendliness I'd found in him earlier had been wrung out. "We have no weapons. We're just trying to make a point." "You've well made it all day. We're going to make a point as well." By 1 in the morning, they had the whole outside of the Opera House surrounded, and they'd started smashing in one of the doors. "Get up here," I ordered, moving to the location. We pushed our way forward with planks, doing our best to keep it reinforced. They fired tear gas in, noxious smoke roiling through at us. We had masks for it and kept on pushing back at the splintered planks we'd nailed up, our shoes slipping on broken glass. "Eddies are in the back," Charlie reported, and we split our forces. But there were more Eddies. As each new breach appeared, we split to deal with it. At 2 in the morning, I ordered the bulk of the project volunteers to fall back to the next floor. The volunteers at the doors faced the Eddies, who punched through and started dragging them away. I left half of the remaining volunteers to hold upper floors, leaning against doors or just forming human chains. The rest of us, 100 now, took to the roof, barricading anything we found on the way up there. We had fewer doors to defend. "They only can land a handful at a time by helicopter," I told a nervous Charlie. "And unlike the military during a riot, they're not going to shoot us because that won't turn them a profit, will it?" The 100 of us on the roof saw dawn break, helicopters hovering around the edges of the building, Eddies camped outside with fellow project members zip-tied to each other and sitting outside in one long line. When they got through, the Eddies kicked and beat us down, making their point. But by then, we really didn't care, did we? Mock Turtle himself came to spring us. "Are you ready to see your apartment?" he asked. But I found that I didn't want it. "What's the next project?" I asked. It was late in the morning a year later. I packed up my home, folding my tent back down. The skinnable walls faded, their pictures and vistas disappearing as I shut the tent off. I packed into the trailer behind my bike, and as I locked it down, the rest of the city around me started to wake up. The smell of fresh coffee wafted over the neighborhood lines as slow wakers got stumbling. Fresh bread, air shipped in from a vertical farm in Columbus, or so everyone said, also filled the air. But I was in a hurry and had decided to skip breakfast. Everything folded up and away with a quick double check to make sure the chalked-off area of my lot for the night was clean, and I was off. Friends from the last months of slow pedaling across the great American West waved at me as I cranked along through the streets of a tent city that had gone up overnight. 5,000 in this particular tribe. I passed security along the edge, and they let me pass. Then it was out along the back roads and trails with my electric assist trike, with the aerodynamic trailer behind me with all my belongings bumping along. I had found over the last year that I didn't need much. I'd even gotten rid of things as I'd moved my way west. This last leg was easy, coming down out of the mountains. I passed a handful of other bicycles and small cars, a few gas-powered. Plus, I had two reasons for L.A. For one, it was our next project. We had a new code name, didn't want the local eddies to sniff us out ahead of time. We were trickling into L.A. a little bit at a time. Project Ceres had an ambitious 100-building goal,